Waters and Johnson & Johnson, 2008-1073. Are you ready to move on, Mr. Disney?
May I please the court? My name is Greg Discamp. I'm appearing on behalf of Cordes. In the district court, Cordes' cipher stamp was found to infringe the Bing patent, and we think that was in error. And there are three separate and independent reasons to reverse that judgment. The cipher stamp does not have the non-thrombogenic coating that Bing requires. The cipher stamp does not have the drug-free TACA that Bing requires, and the Bing patent is invalid over well-known teachings of the prior art.
The problem is that a jury decided all these questions, and there was some evidence which the district court went through and said there was, that constitutes substantial evidence, and so what can we do about that?
Well, I don't persuade you what you can do about it. Let me start with the drug-free TACA, with the thrombogenic TACA, non-thrombogenic TACA, which is a claim construction issue, so it's a question of law, and actually if it's correctly construed on the undisputed facts, we do not infringe. The problem that Bing confronted was that objects placed in bloodstream tend to provoke thrombogenic responses, and in particular, that stents, metal stents, provoke thrombogenic responses. Bing tried to improve on that problem by providing for a non-thrombogenic TACA. District court construed the term non-thrombogenic.
Non-thrombogenic compared with the bare metal?
Well, that's how it should be construed in our view. The district court
Where's that in the claim? The claim doesn't say it has to be a better thrombogenic material, non-thrombogenic material than another. It says simply non-thrombogenic.
Well, I think that's the error the district court made, which is it construed the term non-thrombogenic in isolation.
So
the claim language, actually.
You're saying it's not an absolute term?
First, it's not an absolute term, but more specifically, in response to Judge Rader's question, the claim language requires a non-thrombogenic top coat that provides long-term non-thrombogenicity to the device portion. The device portion is very specifically described in the claim to be at least in part metallic, and the claim further provides that the coating must cover at least part of the metallic portion. So it's a very clear recitation that this non-thrombogenic coating must cover at least part of the metal stent.
In other words, you're saying non-thrombogenic means less thrombogenic than something, and that something is the bare metal sheet.
That's exactly what we're saying. We're saying the claim requires that. And let me point out the error in the district court's approach, which Boston endorses in its brief. And the Boston argues that a non-thrombogenic top coat is met by any product, such as cipher, that's permanently implanted in the coronary arteries and in contact with the blood.
Mr. Disney, didn't your own in-house polymer expert, Dr. Janos, testify that he would have used the same definition?
Sure, but he was addressing a different problem than Dick was, and that's exactly the problem with relying on statements like that. Dr. Ding was addressing the problem of metal stent causing thrombosis. How do we prove that by providing a non-thrombogenic TACA? Janos was creating a stent that addressed a different problem of restenosis. And Cordes' goal was in addressing that different problem not to make things worse. So for purposes of cipher, for purposes of the Cordes product, non-thrombogenic meant no worse than a metal stent, because it was providing this tremendous additional benefit of combating restenosis. You've got to connect up.
The claim doesn't use comparative terms. It simply says non-thrombogenic, long-term benefits, etc.
Respectfully, I disagree with you on that.
Where does it say it's longer term than a metal stent?
It says it must provide, means give.
Yes.
It must give long-term non-thrombogenicity to the device portion.
Absolutely. And the testimony was abundantly, and the jury found it does.
It does not. The Cypher stent is non-thrombogenic. The same reason a bare metal stent is non-thrombogenic is dosed with a regimen.
You want to add a limitation there.
No,
it says longer term than a metal stent.
Respectfully, we don't want to add that limitation. I think that's what Ding is talking about. The evidence was undisputed that the Cypher stent is as bad, essentially, as the bare metal stent on this component.
Maybe you should go on to your substantial.
I'd be happy to do that. The next element is the top coat must be substantially free of drug. Ding required a substantially free top coat in order to delay immediate release of drug.
Is there any drug in the top coat that you apply to your product?
No, sir. That was the problem with their claim application argument. We spray on a drug-free top coat. Immediately after it is sprayed on, because of the selection of polymers and solvents that Cordis makes.
There's a leaching. We've read the breach. But the question is, where does the claim tell us that the timing of doing the analysis of whether there's any drug in the top coat?
The claim requires two elements. One, it requires a drug-free top coat, and it requires a drug-free top coat in a medical device that is implantable in the patient. That's where the combination comes.
Is there anything in the record that tells us that it isn't implantable at the moment you spray on the top coat?
Every doctor who testified said that. There's no contradictory evidence. The evidence...
Implantable means only implantable sometime in the future. Why wouldn't, at the time this is conceivably implanted, it would still be substantially free?
That would be like saying a nail is implantable. You could do it. It would just kill the patient. This is a medical device. It's a patent.
Just because it's a medical device doesn't mean that it has to work or be done properly.
It doesn't have to be done properly.
Medical device isn't defined as something that will work effectively.
It does have to be implantable in a patient. Ding's own patent talks about sterilization.
How soon does the leaching occur?
Instantly. It does it instantly, and that's why Boston's entire case is, for moments, the top coat is drug-free. As it's sprayed on, it's a wet, it's not a medical device. It's a medical device in the process of being manufactured. The product must thereafter, the solvents must be evaporated, it must be dried, it must be cured, it must be sterilized. By the time it is a medical device, meaning approved by FDA to be sold and placed in humans, meaning a product that a doctor would place in humans, the top coat is full of drug. That's an undisputed fact. And under the all elements rule, there's never a time when the top coat is free of drug and it's a medical device.
And having sat through the trial, is it your view, was that the issue that led the jury astray, in your view, or was it the substantially part of it?
I think that is exactly the issue that led the jury astray. If you read the arguments, they were all about essentially manufacturing step arguments. I think the jury got it wrong because the case was tried as though this were a method of manufacturing claim, and that just was off base.
How about Wolf in relation to invalidity?
I'd be happy to talk about Wolf and invalidity. I think this patent is plainly invalid. Wolf and Don are both excellent examples. Wolf provides two embodiments, a multiplicity of embodiments. It has a metal stent with a drug top coat. Right next to it, that's figure 4, figure 3B, there's a polymer stent containing drug and a drug-free top coat. The patent explains that the drug-free top coat is a diffusion barrier. If you wanted a diffusion barrier on your metal stent with the drug, you'd add one.
Is there an issue as to whether the there would be non-thrombogenicity in the wolf top coat?
No, the wolf top coat is silicon.
And silicon can be porous and thereby thrombogenic.
No. Right? Silicon is recognized in the... This is an after the...
Depends upon the kind of silicon, and that isn't really specified by wolf.
Respectfully, those in the art view silicon as non-thrombogenic, that's the unequivocal trial testimony. There was no dispute about this at trial. There's an after-the-fact argument made up by Boston.
Let me ask you, is your obviousness question influenced or affected by which way we come out on claim construction?
No.
For example, doesn't your, on the one hand, which a lot of people are forced to do, arguing for a narrower claim construction, but doesn't that detract from the Wolf patent?
No, the only claim construction issue that we're presenting is the non-thrombogenic issue. So the only claim construction issue is, does it require comparative non-thrombogenicity reduction, or is it sufficient that it, in some amorphous way, be non-thrombogenic?
Sort of in relationship to Judge Rader's question, wouldn't you be on easier ground with respect to silicon if you adopted the district court's claim construction as opposed to the one that you're advocating?
Actually, no, although I think the district court's claim construction makes it easy. But the argument that Judge Rader was just espousing was one Boston espoused only on appeal. It's not an argument. It's supported by the trial record.
Judge Rader espouses no argument.
I'm sorry.
I did pose a question to you that answer.
Then
let me ask you what you do with the secondary considerations.
Secondary considerations all run our way. I mean, basically, you've got the Cypher stent, which was a great success. By the undisputed testimony, it was a great success because it identified the drug rapamycin, which treats restenosis. It has nothing to do with anything in vein. There was no long-felt need for how to come up with coated stents. You see Ding, you see Wolf, you see Dom. There are dozens of ideas. When Cordis came upon Cypher, it was easy for it to create the drug-coated surface. That was child's play. The validity arguments are extraordinarily strong. Dom is just as strong as Wolf, and Dom's exactly the same idea. It's got it's a medical device for esophageal or bronchial stents. It's got a drug. Its underlip coating has drug in it. Its top coating is silicone. Its top coating is drug-free. And their only argument at trial, which they repeat on appeal, is that one of skill in the art wouldn't know that an esophageal or bronchial stent could be made of metal and have an open lattice structure. Boston itself had approval for such a stent. Now, these are essentially laughable arguments to those of skill in the art, and the skill in the art was very, very high. Thank you.
We'll save the rest of your argument for the public.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
You're going to have to give us a pinch.
Now, there was one point that Mr. Discant started with that I'd like to address and correct, and that's his statement that Boston Scientific's, quote, entire case is that the moment it's sprayed on, is drug-free. And that's just simply not correct. There was testimony both by Dr. Hoffenberg, who is BSC's expert witness, and also Cordis witnesses as to the amount of drug that moved into the top coat following the application.
Is there any question that it's 23% and almost very quickly after it's sprayed on?
That's not clear at all in the record, Your Honor. And in fact, the testimony by Dr. Hoffenberg I'll point to, which Judge Rodgers referred to. Okay. So this, Your Honor, is on page, in the record, A1033. The transcript page is 756 to 757. This is on cross-examination, where Dr. Hoffenberg says, at the point where we have an implantable device that doesn't have 23% in the top coat, it has numbers like Mr. Discant was speaking about, maybe 1 or 2% or a very, very small amount.
At what point is that?
I'm sorry?
At what point is that? You use the claim language, implantable, but what time is that actually?
If you look at the transcript, Your Honor, I think it shows at the conclusion of the manufacturing process, after it's been treated with the solvents.
Yes, you have to sterilize it so there's a period of time there, and then you have to let the solvent dissipate, and so there's a period of days, right?
I don't believe the record says how long that period takes. What there is, which is important.
So what are you saying is the implantable? When is it implantable?
Well, Dr. Hoffenberg's testimony is that it's implantable when the manufacturing process is completed, which is when the top coat has been applied, it's been smoothed with the toluene. And that was his testimony, and he's applying the court's claim construction.
So it is how long is that into the process?
That's right when it's manufactured. The 23% number, it's very clear from the record. And that number, by the way, came from Dr. Hoffenberg's evaluation of the elution data, of the fast and the slow curves, the green and the red that you talk about, which is included in our brief at page 51. He said it eventually got to 23%. This is the transcript. It's A978, transcript page 636. So the proposition that as soon as the manufacturing process is complete, you get to 23% is not supported by the record. What Dr. Hoffenberg was talking about was this device that was tested in the coronary arteries of pigs that obviously had been manufactured sometime previously. I think it's also important to note on this topic, Dr. Hansen, who was Cordes' expert witness, testified in the record at page A1344, transcript page 1499, that when the solvent is applied with the top coat, a little bit of redistribution occurs. A little bit is a direct quote. That's his phrase. And then he testified on the same page that when the device was dry, it, quote, tends to pull some drug into the top coat, and it's very likely that it pulls up some drug, quote, to some extent. And then again, when he gives his opinion of non-infringement, he talks about sterilization, and he says, quote, some drug, close quote, is in the top coat.
I'm looking at 1033. Can you show me again where there's testimony? This makes it clear when the device is implantable and what the percentage is at that point.
Okay. On the top of the page, on 756,
yes,
at the top, starting around line 2, where the answer to the question is, in the context that we're speaking here, sir, at the point where it's implantable, and that means at the point where the manufacturing process is complete, it would not be 23% of the top coat. Then on the same page of the appendix...
Who's that responding?
That's Dr. Hoffenberg on cross-examination by Mr. Discant.
How much would it be at that point? Does he ever say?
Well, he does a little bit further down on this same page. The transition from transcript page 756 to 757, starting at around line 22. What I'm absolutely sure of is that when you actually manufacture the device or create an implantable device which uses a drug-free top coat, that's the point where we have an implantable device. It doesn't have 23% in the top coat. It has numbers like Mr. Discant was speaking about, maybe 1% or 2%, or a very, very small amount. Now,
isn't the trouble here how we define implantable? Because wasn't it undisputed by the experts, including your own, that you wouldn't implant a stent prior to sterilization?
It seemed from the medical experts that people agreed that you would not put a cardiac stent in a person without sterilizing.
But you seem to be arguing that it is implantable even without the sterilization.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there's 2 points that I would like to make on that. First of all, the application of the claim construction to the set of facts is appropriately a question of fact for expert witnesses. And Dr. Hoffenberg was qualified as an expert and testified to that. There's a case that I would point the court to that I think is valuable on this point.
But we can look at this as a question of law, claim construction, as to whether there is substantially free at the implantable point, right?
Well, it can be. Sometimes
you can look at
sometimes
it either way.
The line's hard to draw, Your Honor.
It is hard to draw in this case.
Right. The case that I would like to point the court to that I'm referring, Your Honor, Judge Probst, is Cordes versus Medtronic, which is 339 F 3rd 1352. In that case, the claim required that the connector members, also a snake case, that the connector members be substantially parallel to the cylindrical members that they connected. And the device, in fact, undisputedly, had connector members that were longer in the opposite direction. And this went to the jury. A Cordes expert testified that the shape was not important, but the way to look at it is to draw a line between the members that are connected, and when you do that, you see the short axis is substantially parallel. But what I think is important is the court's discussion of that. This is on page 1363 of the decision, where the court clearly treated that as a question of fact, said that the jury was entitled to credit that testimony in terms of how to apply the claim construction to the device.
How do you get by Wolf?
Wolf, Your Honor, one point that I would certainly want to start with is that it is on record during prosecution. Now, the testimony is clear looking at it that Wolf has two layers of polymer which both contain drug in figure 3B. It states that the outer layer is erodible, and it also, this is on page 989 of the appendix.
And is the outer layer silicon?
I don't recall what all the outer layers were disclosed in Wolf, but I do recall that Wolf specifically teaches an erodible polymer, which is obviously precluded by the characterization of the top coat in the Helmus and Ding patent. The testimony by the experts on this is in 989 and 1429 of the record. Both BSC's expert and Cordes' expert agreed that Wolf does not teach a metallic stent that has two coatings. Rather, there's an embodiment here where there's a polymer stent that has a coating, but there's not one with it. Also, Your Honor, the court asked Mr. Discant about secondary considerations, which is something that
I want to address. Well, that's what I'm interested in. Under KSR, we're kind of required to extrapolate a little. I didn't understand your point because it's got one embodiment that does one thing and another that does the other thing.
Right.
Well, you can't sort of go to the second step and say that it would have been obvious to do both at one time.
I don't think you can say that it necessarily would be obvious or that it necessarily would not be obvious. But in any event, when you look at the testimony the Cordes relies on, the Cordes expert witness really just went through and showed elements of the Ding Helmus claims in different pieces of the prior art, and then just said, well, it would be obvious to modify, it would be obvious to change, with no explanation as to why. And although KSR certainly emphasized that we do not have a rigid test for motivation and combination, it does not absolve the person challenging validity of the obligation to provide persuasive testimony as to why a person skilled in the art would make the change or would make the modification or the combination. And that simply was not here. With respect to secondary considerations, Mr. Discant, on argument, said something to the effect that it was undisputed that the success was the drug selection, which is sirolimus, also known as rapamycin. But there was specific testimony, again, in the record by Dr. Hoffenberg. This is on page 1056 of the appendix, who talks about how the success and the utility of the Cypher stent also depends on the controlled release of the drug, which is results from the membranes and from the use of the claimed invention here. There was also substantial evidence of long-felt need and tried and failed. Three of the prior art references the court has principally relied on belonged to Medtronic, and yet Medtronic was going all along in a different direction, which was trying to do erodible polymers. which become rough, are not biostable, have pores, attract the platelets, and generate clots, and therefore are not non-thrombogenic. And in fact, Horace was doing that as well. The testimony was by their internal development people was that they were going down that road for a long time using erodible polymers to get
the Wolf patent explicitly discusses the problem of thrombosis and the need to combat it. Why would the jury come to the conclusion that there was an absence of thrombogenicity in Wolf?
Wolf does not talk about using a dual layer coating.
Yeah, but you've got 3B right next to figure 4 in the patent, and so we're right back where Judge Prost had you a minute ago. Why can't you just take the drug component of 3B and plug it into figure 4?
Perhaps a person might make that argument, might do it. But there was testimony in the record that the differences between metallic stents and polymer stents, how you coat them and why you coat them and when you do controlled release, were all meaningful. And this went to the jury under an undisputed claim construction. I'm sorry, under an uncontested jury instruction on obviousness, which the court held not that long ago in another court's case, was perfectly consistent with KSR. It is unreviewable as invited error, which is what the court held in that case as well.
The instruction requires specific finding motivation, identifying specific teaching or motivation.
What it required, Your Honor, it did, well, it said that it said that it could come from the knowledge of a person's skill in the art, is what it said. And that was specifically the sentence that the court cited in the Cordes case that I referred to a moment ago, which is Cordes v. Medtronic, another one, same name, 511 F3rd 1157. My role. I will get the exact phraseology that was used in that case, which was used in this case.
Can I jump back to another point?
Sorry.
How can you have an implantable device before it's sterilized?
Implantable.
You wouldn't implant something that's going to kill the patient.
Well, implantable here, I think, clearly refers to the character, to the geometry, to the structure of the device. There's a statement in the specification that I would point to.
Implantable means capable of being implanted. I don't think there's any problem with that interpretation.
No, I don't think there is, Your Honor. I think
so. Is it something which can be implanted? You're not going to implant an unsterile device, are you? An incomplete device.
Well,
and therefore, if you've got to go through the sterilization, doesn't that take your Dr. Hoppenberg testimony off the table?
Well, I can make two brief points on that, Your Honor. I see my time is up. The first one is point to the portion of the specification that I was alluding to, which is column 3, around line 12, where it talks about the devices that can benefit from this. It talks about extracorporeal circuits, like in a dialysis machine or a phoresis machine, that are outside the body. And in fact, one of the prior art references that was talked about was
get to my question.
Okay.
Implantable or not before it's sterilized?
It is physically implantable, so the claim limitation is
that. You're advocating implantation of a non-sterilized product.
I'm certainly not advocating anything. And there's no question that when a device like this is used in people, it should be and must be sterilized.
And but can it be implanted before that?
Yes, it can be. The other
That sounds to me like...
You mean physically, but it's not medically ready.
That would be correct, Your Honor. And the other point that I would just briefly make in response to Your Honor's, Judge Rader's question, is even if we look at when does it have to be sterilized, etc., we still have a make infringement in this case. Make use sell. There may not be a sale infringement, depending on when it leaves the warehouse, but we clearly have a make infringement, and that is sufficient to affirm the jury's verdict. If there's no other questions, I brought
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Discan, there's a little rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Do you have a main infringement on that lot?
No, they don't. You still have to make an implantable device. It's not made until it's sterile. I don't understand the argument at all.
I have a thermometer at home. Once in a while, I get a fever. I take my temperature and I put it aside. Maybe my wife has something too, so she picks it up. It is implantable in the mouth, even though it hasn't been sterilized, right?
It is, but a stent isn't. A stent must be sterilized. And the dependent claim 8 calls for a stent.
She doesn't want to pick up my disease thermometer and put it on her mouth anymore than you want to sterilize.
Yeah. Well, this is not to me, the patent itself tells you the answer. I mean, Ding is talking about a medical device. Ding shows a diagram to make the medical device in figure 1. The last step is sterilization. In column 9, Ding says, stents coated and cured in the manner described need to be sterilized. I don't think there's a serious doubt that a medical device of this patent is a sterilized medical device. And if it is a sterilized medical device, that case, their infringement case disappears. If I could just spend a moment on the KSR point, and then I'll sit down. I think this is a very simple, straightforward KSR case. This is not rocket science. Frankly, it's not rocket science for the people in this courtroom to read Wolf and understand you could put the diffusion coating on top of the metal stent.
We deal with rocket science all the time.
I'll stay away from my analogies. The art here is very high level. These are PhD scientists working in this field, working with polymers containing drugs, working in blood-contacting environments. They all testified at trial. Probably the entire art testified at trial. They all learned about the fusion coatings in graduate school. This is not sophisticated stuff. Adding a diffusion layer to slow down release of a drug from a drug-containing layer is, you know, a 101 course in grad school. These PhD scientists all knew it. And I think it's very important for you to take a look at the testimony opposite ours. It all came from Dr. Hockenberg, who used the wrong level of skill in the art. There is, I think, no serious rebuttal to the evidence that as a matter of law, this court performing its legal obligations under KSR, this is simply the combination of known elements for their known functions achieving predictable outcomes. The patent should be declared invalid. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Liskamp. Case will be taken under advisement.